out at a sea of people sleeping on the street, all of whom are breaking the law by sleeping on the street, and says, you know, arresting one of these people is just not going to do any good, is doing the right analysis, but only at one level. All of the people sleeping on the street are perfectly aware that the police officer will look out at the sea of them and decide that none of them is worth arresting, and now sleeping on the street is effectively lawful in that area. And it's a tipping problem, right? If you can get the level of enforcement high enough so that the probability of arrest for some violation gets to be big enough to discourage people, well, then they stop doing it, and then you can stop arresting them. So if you can push yourself over that hump, you can get from a very disorderly place to a more orderly place with only a temporary spike in arrests. Right? If you had to keep making the arrests for the rest of eternity, it just couldn't be done. But the question is, can you concentrate and eventually get yourself down on the other side of the hump? And the answer is, as Jim pointed out, and as George has done in various places, is yes. And that sort of dynamic concentration is something that we ought to pay more attention to in all of our law enforcement activities. But deconcentration is a fine thing. I don't think we should be happy with the fact that we have no idea where those folks went. Some of them went to state prison. It's a pretty expensive homeless shelter, the last time I checked. Lots of them presumably went to other parts of the city. Whether they're doing more harm or less harm where they are than where they were, I don't think we know yet. And so it's easy to take a picture of a street that's been cleaned up and say, oh, this is wonderful, but you're not taking a picture of the street that's been messed up by the same people. Still, it seems to be quite likely, A, that concentration's a bad thing, dispersion's better, and B, that if we're going to have concentration, it probably shouldn't be in the middle of downtown that we're trying to revitalize. I think we'd all be better off if we were frank about that rather than if we were euphemistic about it. One question to raise is, well, what's the opportunity cost? Right? It's not as if we've got, I mean, thanks to Chief Bratton and the department, we've had a miraculous recovery from crime in the city, but we're still a pretty high violent crime city. How many other lives could have been saved with those 50 officers for what, a year and a half? Something like that? I mean, that's a pretty big investment. If you'd put it in South LA, how many blocks could you reclaim from the Crips and the Bloods? I don't know the answer to that question, but it seems to me one worth asking. This is a pretty massive investment of police resources. And strikingly, it was an investment almost only of police resources. Seems to me that the right critique of the Safer Cities program, if you want to criticize it, is that it's a hammer and nail problem. If all you've got is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. The police department, as usual, is the only agency that has to be there. And so they were told, go fix this problem, and they fixed the problem the way they knew how to fix the problem. But where the hell's everybody else? Both Jim and Heather McDonald suggested that lots of the folks on Skid Row prefer to sleep outdoors. You know, I sort of doubt it. It's sort of like the U.S. auto industry, you know, insisting that, you know, our cars are fine, there's something wrong with the customers. My guess is that lots of people prefer to sleep outdoors to being prayed over, prefer to sleep outdoors to being bossed around. But the question is, where's the low-threshold shelter? Where's the shelter you can go to at 11 o'clock at night, stoned, and sleep indoors? I don't know how many of the people on Skid Row would go into that shelter. But it seems to me it's a question worth asking. San Diego built a new SRO. And it turned out that lots of those people actually had $5 for a bed if they could get it by the night rather than by the month. So it seems to me that's something that's being underinvested in. I think it's, according to the report I read about Skid Row, a lot of the drug problem is heroin. Well, heroin's the one drug problem we actually can treat our way out of. I mean, it's not as if we have any very useful treatment for people who use crack or methamphetamine. There's no such thing as an empty slot in a methadone program. You got methadone available, people will take it, and when they take methadone, they take less heroin and they commit fewer crimes. And if you can't cite the methadone clinic, so bring in the van. But it seems to me that's a pretty straightforward thing to do, that as far as I can tell is not being done. The LA City Jail is still dumping people on Skid Row when they get released. That seems like not very clever. We still have a jail overcrowding problem, which means streets or services was a joke, right? The notion was, you know, either you're going to go to jail or you're going to take these services, except there wasn't a place to put you in jail, so you got released after 24 hours. Not surprising, lots of people turned down that deal. We've got no threat left. If we want to fix the crime problem, we better get moving on to jail. As far as I can tell, nobody's even talking about expanding jail capacity in a place where you do 10% of your nominal jail sentence. And, again, this is something that could be done in jail since lots of these folks cycle through. We didn't talk much about the infectious disease problem, but if you look at those pictures and, you know, if you've got any public health background, you're saying to yourself, oh my God, hepatitis B, hepatitis C, tuberculosis. As far as I can tell, the LA County Jail doesn't even bother to test people, either on the way in or the way out. So it does seem to me there's lots of stuff that could be done on top of safer cities. That would both help maintain the cleanup of the area and provide some services for the folks there. But I don't think we should just congratulate ourselves because we made it impossible to live on the street in Skid Row until we figure out where people are going to live instead. So I hope that's the full quota of criticism I was hired to provide. And thanks to all of you. Very nice. The final speaker on this panel is Carol Wilkins. She is Director of Intergovernmental Policy with the Corporation for Supportive Housing, where she works to develop and support the implementation of policy solutions to end long-term homelessness for people who have complex health needs and multiple barriers to employment. I think she will give us a reflection on just how complicated this issue is. And it's our great pleasure to have with us today Carol Wilkins. Carol.
Thanks. I think I'm just going to speak from here. Thank you. Can folks hear me? I think my job today is to speak as a little bit of an outsider. I've spent time visiting Skid Row over the last few years and certainly spent a lot of time talking to folks who are working on the problems of Skid Row. But my job is, if as Mark described, if what we've been talking about is a hammer and nail problem, I think part of my job is to talk about what some of the other tools might be and how other communities, other cities have worked to restore public order and address some of the problems you've heard described today using another set of tools, and I hope that's helpful. I work for the Corporation for Supportive Housing. We're a national nonprofit organization. We help communities create permanent housing with services to prevent and end homelessness. And what I want to do is talk a little bit. A couple of years ago, I was asked by the federal government, by HUD and HHS, who were sponsoring a research symposium on homelessness, to take a look at the last decade of research about particularly chronic street homelessness, long-term homelessness. So I spent a lot of time with my colleagues reviewing pretty much everything that's been published in the last decade, learned a lot from that research about who those people are who are living on the streets of our cities, how did they get to be living in places like Skid Row, who are the people who, when they enter homelessness, are most likely to get stuck and remain homeless for years on end, what does it cost when people are homeless, and what are some of the unintended consequences, perhaps, of this revolving door between our jails and our streets, and finally to touch on some of the better solutions, and to do all of that in 7 minutes. When we looked at the research nationally, and I think the characteristics from studies in Skid Row are really consistent with this data, certainly we're talking about a group that's predominantly men. Racial and ethnic minorities, particularly African Americans, are seriously overrepresented among this population. What's striking is that the average age of people living on the streets and long-term homelessness is now about 49, and it's getting about a year older every year, just like the rest of us. So it's a cohort of folks, largely, who are experiencing long-term homelessness or at risk of long-term homelessness. They're now very close to 50. Very high rates of unemployment and other things that we understand and would expect. But also, most of them don't have families to return to. In fact, a very large percentage of them experienced foster care placement in childhood. And when we look at the health conditions here, In addition to the alcohol and drug problems, which are very prevalent among people living on the streets, over half have serious mental illness and very, very high rates of serious medical conditions, HIV/AIDS, other life-threatening diseases, and other chronic health conditions. So that 50-year-old chronically homeless person living on the streets has a health status that looks more like your typical 80-year-old in this country. Locally, researchers have said that 80% or more of those people living on the streets of Skid Row are suffering from severe and chronic mental illness, addiction, serious health problems, or some combination of all of those. When researchers look at those people, lots of people in America today end up experiencing homelessness. Over half of the people living in the bottom fifth of the income distribution in this country spend more than half their income in rent. So when that happens, lots of people fall into homelessness briefly. The characteristics of people who get stuck in homelessness, who stay there for months and years on end, include a history of being in foster care as children, experiencing very serious violence and victimization, both as children and then increasingly as adults, and certainly the what you heard earlier is, I think, some insight into some of the violence that homeless people experience living on the streets. But for many, this violence and victimization began in childhood. Very high rates of substance abuse increases the likelihood that someone will remain homeless. A history of involvement in the criminal justice system. So someone who's never been homeless before, who gets dropped by the sheriff or the criminal justice, you know, release system at the front door of the shelter system, is more likely to be stuck there a year later than someone who doesn't have a history of involvement in incarceration. Older adults who enter the shelter system are at greater risk of remaining in the shelter system for a long time. When we looked at patterns of service utilization, so where are these folks going? There are very high rates of use of shelters, hospital inpatient beds, emergency rooms, jails and prisons, and detox programs. Very low rates of engagement and retention in outpatient mental health services, substance abuse treatment, and primary care. So while many of us might wish that folks who are living on the streets would get into substance abuse treatment, stay in treatment programs, complete those programs, and then exit into housing, what we know is that for the vast majority of folks who are homeless and living on the streets, that route through substance abuse treatment into housing is not going to work for most of them. That's not the pathway that most people are going to take into housing and off the streets. Even programs that are designed for homeless street alcoholics or homeless folks living on the streets with serious drug problems have very low rates of retention, so that the majority of participants are either asked to leave or they walk away from the programs before they're halfway through. And this is all very expensive. Studies that looked at the cost of care for homeless people with mental illness or addiction found annual costs, and depending on the city, it might be $17,000, might be $42,000, but in urban areas where there's significant services available, the costs ended up usually in the $30,000 to $40,000 a year range. Ambulance and hospital care for chronic public inebriates, the street alcoholics, just those two areas, ambulance and hospital care in several cities, the studies found that was about $8,000 a year for serving people in those settings. And in California, the Corporation for Supportive Housing is heading up a program initiative in six counties, working with hospitals, looking at the most frequent users of hospital emergency room care. Again, we found the most frequent users of hospital emergency rooms are homeless individuals with multiple serious health and behavioral health conditions. And these folks are dying on the streets. What we find when those same individuals get into supportive housing, the utilization of those expensive emergency and inpatient services, in study after study, that service utilization is reduced by more than half. There's a revolving door between our jails and prisons and our streets, and certainly we heard a little bit about that earlier, but I think the scale and the magnitude of that is really important. One of the things that I looked at in preparing for this is some material on the Manhattan Institute website. There was a forum that they held in 2006 looking at issues of recidivism and reentry and reintegration of men into the mainstream in our American cities. And I left out on the table some information there related to some of that. But what we found In that information and work CSH has been involved with on reentry, there are enormously high rates of incarceration in the last few years. And one of the speakers in the Manhattan Institute session on this talked about the fact that we've had a 757% increase in incarceration among women over the last 30 years and a 257% increase in rates of incarceration among men during a period of time when crime rates have remained relatively flat. So our perception, our concerns about public order and public safety, our changes in public policy have incarcerated literally millions of Americans more than we were incarcerating in past years. And we now have a revolving door that brings those folks back to our streets in places like Skid Row. Rates of shelter use among people leaving prison are higher than among people leaving psychiatric hospitals. In LA, 50% of parolees were homeless in a study done about a decade ago. And in the handout there, I added another statistic. More than 20,000 homeless people cycle through in and out of LA's jails every year. And so what we see is this cycle where individuals with very high rates of mental illness and substance abuse disorders are now increasingly incarcerated instead of being hospitalized. Incarceration and felony convictions can lead to a loss of housing. What we hear is that through, as perhaps one of the unintended consequences of safer cities, dozens of supportive housing tenants who were beginning to put their lives back together and beginning to get off the streets and into housing have been arrested, and federal housing subsidies can't get paid for empty apartments while people stay in jail too long, so they lose their housing. If individuals end up with felony drug convictions, that can lead to long-term barriers to eligibility for housing assistance, as well as some of the other services and supports that would help people get back on track. And at the Manhattan Institute conference in the proceedings, one of the quotes I pulled from that I think is really important. Commissioner Martin Horn from the New York City Department of Corrections said, "If we were serious about changing the cycle, we would ask the question of government, how much do you invest in seeing to it that upon release from prison or jail, every offender goes someplace other than a homeless shelter?" I want to mention quickly, every one of these homeless men and women living on our streets in places like Skid Row came from a family. And some of the research helps us understand the family backgrounds of these individuals. They certainly, as adults, have a lack of family connections and support, and in many cases, a history of family instability, victimization, foster care, and out-of-home placement. Many of these individuals experienced homelessness for the first time when they were children. And among the women that we see living on our streets and in shelters, most are mothers, the vast majority are mothers, but the longer they remain homeless, the more likely they are to be separated from their children. And again, particularly among the women on the streets, very high rates of foster care placement, victimization, physical assault, and rape. So in the last couple minutes, I'm just going to hit on some of the other tools. Supportive housing is a cost-effective combination of permanent, affordable housing with the services that help people live more stable and productive lives. There's a handout in the back, a lot more information about supportive housing available. I can't go into all of it here, but the key is that the housing is permanent. Tenants pay 30% of their income in rent for the most part, and they have access to a wide array of supportive services that help support first and foremost housing stability and provide the services and supports for recovery and resiliency. More than 80% of those individuals in study after study, more than 80% of the individuals who are formerly chronically homeless remain in supportive housing for at least a year. Tenants engage in services even when it's not a mandate or a condition of housing. And housing is a critical factor, what we think of as a foundation for engaging in the services that support recovery. Utilization of emergency services declines, incarceration goes down. The bundle of strategies that works includes targeted outreach linked to available housing, not a shelter bed on a top bunk in a room with another 150 people, but a room of your own with a key in the door. Simplified eligibility process, sobriety is not a precondition for housing. Leases establish clear requirements and expectations for behavior. The subsidies make the housing affordable. The services basically offer whatever it takes to keep people housed, and that housing stability then becomes the starting point on the road to recovery. City of Portland has done this and found dramatic reductions in the numbers of unsheltered homeless individuals and street crime. I left on the back table also a press release that just was released a week ago from the mayor's office in Seattle, citing dramatic savings resulting from supportive housing programs utilizing this kind of an approach. What's striking in the Seattle press release is that in housing about 100 people, they were able to document savings of over $3 million in the first year. That means that savings of about $30,000 per person housed in those programs. I'd really love to see a similar press release from the mayor's office in Los Angeles citing the outcomes from housing chronically homeless people from Skid Row in supportive housing in the future.
Thank you. I think first we'll let the panelists interchange with one another, and I think Professor Klayman had a comment.
Yeah, just something I left out, Jenna left out. It was mentioned that many of the people involved here are on parole. I assume that lots of those who aren't on parole are on probation because they got arrested for something or other. And yet nobody even raised the question about where the parole agents and the probation officers are. Again, without any capacity in the jail, it's hard to do what we know works, which is provide clear rules and immediate but mild sanctions for violating those rules. So either we need more jail capacity or we need some other kind of capacity to make probation and parole real. But it's sort of weird to be talking about this population and nobody even raises the question of the criminal justice institutions that nominally have them in charge.
Well, of course, the ACLU sued the LAPD for doing parole sweeps, so their hands have been tied as well. I would just reemphasize, though, I think that we've lost sight of the fact that really the Skid Row initiative is about behavior, not status. I mean, Mark, you may claim that it's really about the people themselves, but what had been allowed to develop on Skid Row was a culture of lawlessness. And as one of the senior lead officers, Dion Joseph, said to me, I don't care if there's 150 people hanging out on San Julian Street as long as they're obeying the law. Skid Row had a national reputation. People came from across the country because they knew that this was the place where you could live for free and do what you want, that there was it was a law-free zone. And while certainly Carol's suggestions are absolutely valid, I think there's a sense of almost infantilizing this population, of talking about the services that we can provide, which is fine. Society has an obligation towards its most vulnerable and least fortunate members. But I think in sort of announcing either implicitly or explicitly, as I think some of these advocates have done, you have no duty to obey the law, you are infantilizing them. And the one of the most important steps you can take in moving towards the rehab is to say, we expect you to obey the laws like everybody else. And saying that you have a blank check, again, creates the sort of destruction that Commander Smith has talked about. People were killing each other and killing themselves because for too long the police have been prevented from enforcing laws that everybody else takes for granted. And I think, you know, while certainly housing is a necessity, I think expectations of law-abiding behavior are also necessary.
Well, you know, I think we all can find some common ground here. I think we all recognize that there are not enough beds and not enough housing for folks, you know, in the Skid Row area, and certainly not enough for all the people in all of Los Angeles. And a lot of things that the professor was saying, you know, I quite frankly have to agree with. There's a lot more that we as a society and as a city and as a county especially can do for this population that we have here. Recognize that in every major city I've ever been in, there's always going to be homeless folks, whether it's here or in Europe or anywhere. And I think if you look at Main Street, which was the first street that we really started work on, even before we started the Safer Cities Project, Sergeant McManus and the folks in the back had a Main Street project, which was, we looked at Main Street and we said, look, this is out of control. We got to change the way this is. This is in 2005, late 2005, beginning of 2006. Main Street project, we recognized that we did a survey. At 3 in the morning, there were 130 people wandering up and down Main Street. No businesses were open. These were folks that either lived and camped on the street there, across the street from Chrysalis, or across the street from Pete's Cafe, or just were hanging out there because they're Blood gang members who got a hotel room at the Huntington and were out there selling their dope. They're up all night selling dope back and forth. They sleep during the day on the sidewalks over there because we were prohibited from doing anything about them. After we focused on Main Street with enough resources and police officers to change the kind of behaviors that Heather was talking about, things have completely changed on Main Street. And I cut out an article from this week's Downtown News in the back there that talks about one of the places to watch is Main Street between 4th and 7th. And 5 years ago, if you would have said that's going to be one of the quickest growing places downtown, with the exception of Pete's Cafe, there was nothing there. It was a wasteland of people camping out and whatnot. But you go down there, you still see homeless folks walking around. You still see once in a while someone who obviously has some type of, you know, mental issues or mental health issues or whatever. But they're coexisting with the lady that owns the Metropolis bookstore, with the lady that lives in the loft up above Pete's Cafe, with the folks that are, you know, running the Chinese or the Vietnamese food restaurant down there. It's like, I think, a city's supposed to be. A little bit of everybody there.
Before we turn to the audience, I have a question that anyone should feel free to answer. And again, it's sort of first principles. Does anyone have a right to live on the street? I mean, the country does have a history of vagrancy laws for a reason, because we thought these things would spiral out of control the way they have now spiraled out of control and which you're now addressing. So the question is, does anyone have a right to live on the street? Or if we see 150 people, even if they're behaving themselves, is it still okay to be a vagrant?
Well, I think the laws are crafted, certainly the LAPD sidewalk law is crafted a little more narrowly than that to maybe avoid taking on that specific issue. If you are blocking the sidewalk, if you are occupying public space in a way that interferes with other people's use of that public space, there is no right for that. Again, cities are these extraordinarily vital, dynamic places that the Manhattan Institute and many other institutes, the Milken Institute, are trying to bring to their fullest potential. And if you let one group sort of stake a claim to colonize the sidewalks, I think the consequences are spread far, far beyond, and the resources that are needed to provide the sort of help that Carol rightly invokes will not be there if you kill cities by allowing public spaces to become places of absolute anarchy.
Well, I'm probably the last guy you'd think is a civil libertarian, but actually I think I am. I think that we as a society have a right to say, you know what, no, you can't just throw a tent up and start camping on a piece of public sidewalk, as long as there's some kind of an alternative for the person to go to. And I agree with you know, some of the things that have been said. You know, a cot in a room with 100 other guys, maybe that's not enough of an alternative. But I think if we can provide a place where someone can have a key to a door and a little bit of privacy, then I think we have a right to say, you know what, no, you can't sit on a tent, you know, down the street from the police station. You can't take that up as your new home, because that's a sidewalk for all of us. But I think we have to have some kind of a reasonable alternative, too.
Okay, good. Let's open it up to the audience for questions. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, my name is Jamie Romano. I'm a former Skid Row drug addict, a two-strike felon. Well-recovered social justice activist and humanitarian these days. It's a pleasure to be here. I am not here in opposition at all. I'm here in the spirit of collaboration. I think the us versus them mentality from all sides doesn't serve anybody. I believe I offer a unique perspective because I've sat on that curb on Main Street and shot dope. Statute of limitations has expired. I was sure to check that. And I've worked in social services. I work on the front lines of homelessness. Obviously, now I enjoy living in a nice neighborhood where there is lots of law and order and safety. But for all of us, all the parties involved, we've seen this as a very multi-layered issue. For all of us to look at each other's perspectives and find the common ground. And I know the us versus them exists on a lot of sides. I've read everything written by everybody here today. I've done some contact with, I will utter the words, Los Angeles Community Action Network and residents of Skid Row that I still keep in touch with. And the collaboration needs to happen. We need to see each other's perspectives. The advocates don't advocate lawlessness. And all the multi-layers and ways to protect people, people are doing their best. LAPD is protecting people. LAPD is sometimes, the legal system is an obstacle to people.
Was there a question? That's a great sentiment. We appreciate that very much.
Well, it's much more than a sentiment. And my question is, if we are here today discussing the criminalization of homelessness, where are the voices, not just the academics criticizing policy, where are the people representing the homeless and their interests and their experience? Where is the forum where they are heard and considered and regarded?
Okay, good question. Does anybody want to address that?
I guess I'd love to respond because as you began speaking, I thought she should have been on our panel. So I was glad that you said what you said. I think you're one of the real experts in the room on this issue, and I really appreciate what you've said. And as you were saying it struck me that, you know, sometimes things, for good or bad, and my job, my role here isn't to defend some of the public behavior that I think disturbs everyone and victimizes many people. But sometimes things have to get so bad before anyone even looks to see what's going on in the lives of these folks. And I would really hope that in that same spirit of collaboration, of really beginning to understand and listen to one another's perspectives, if the political will and the resources that have gone into this effort so far translate into the political will to do something better, to address the needs that now more people are looking at, then we can come out the other end of this with something that we can all be proud of. So thank you.
And there's a microphone, it looks like, back there. This gentleman up here. And if you have a question, raise your hand and I'll have the other microphone go to you.
I know, I don't need a microphone.
I'm the town crier. You know, I'm just going to lay it out bluntly, and I'm going to lay it out so that people can understand and I'm going to ask the question because I have to ask the question. I've been living in transitional housing in Skid Row since 1999 and permanent housing in Skid Row since 1999. And let me tell you something. All the people can come in here and tell you that, you know, the people aren't being heard. But when he speaks, the people are being heard. Okay? There are people in my building, no offense to anyone, but there are people in those buildings down there that would stand in front of the building and wait for a woman to walk by because they could offer her a $5 hit of crack for sex. Okay? And that still goes on. So who's protecting those people? All right? Who's speaking for those people? He's speaking for those people, okay? It's still happening. The other thing, I've seen the changes. I've had the opportunity when Estela Lopez from the bid was putting up those bright lights so that way those dope dealers would be scared from certain places and, well, at least have the light shined upon them. And I would email her and say, how come my light, and how come there's not a light in front of my building? Across the street is a transitional housing in the toy district, where a friend of mine got brain damage. A year she was clean, okay? And this is a transitional housing facility for the dually diagnosed, somebody that suffers with mental illness and a substance abuse problem. And the dope man was sitting right there, feeding her crack one night. as I walk by. Fear, because I'm not going to say anything. You don't want to approach these people when the crack man is right there, or was right there. And when I came back that evening from my choir rehearsal, her face was on the sidewalk, her lips in urine, while the crack man was laughing at her, or laughing, having a good time. I walked in, got my friends, we brought her inside. 2 days later, they found her in a room foaming at the mouth, brain damage in the hospital. Who's speaking for these people? That man right there. Okay? For too long, this neighborhood has gone with lawlessness, has been lawless. And we've allowed that to happen. People have allowed that to happen. Not because they didn't care, but because it wasn't convenient at the time. Because you could isolate the people. You didn't have to see it. But who's speaking for these people now? That man right there. But you can attack him all you want to. I live there. My question right now is, we don't have a bid in a certain part of downtown in Skid Row. And right now, I'm afraid because I hear my landlord asking, are we going to get that money for our security guards and for our parks people that watch that area, that work with the LAPD to make sure that that part of the area continues to somehow get as good as the areas that the bid is in. This is what's going on. You have residents now living there, like me, people in Skid Row Housing Trust, people that can go to the bids and ask, or the LAPD, email a senior lead officer and say something's going on. Nobody's listening to me. Please listen to me. Please help me. Even the homeless people are doing that. These advocates, so-called advocates, don't speak for me. They don't speak for my neighbors, the ones that continue to suffer, because they want to prove a point, some sort of a point that they have the right to have this place continue to be lawless. This isn't about gentrification in Skid Row. There are 88,000 homeless people in the county and city of Los Angeles right now, yet everybody's focused on a little over 500 that sleep on the streets at night in Skid Row. Why is that?
Very well said.
Why? Why is that? So my question to all of you in this room, please help us in that area. Please help my landlord, SRO Housing Corporation, when they go up and try to ask for the money for their security guards, because it's their security guards that also watch out for me. I guarantee you, if SRO Housing Corporation had those security guards there, I wouldn't want to live there. I guarantee you I would be probably living out on the street because it'd probably be safer. But out on the street somewhere outside of downtown and outside of Skid Row. So let me tell you this right now. We need on-site supportive housing. That's what we need to push for. We need to push for it in all of our housing, SRO Housing Corporation, Skid Row Housing Trust. That's what was missing. But the most important thing, the conclusion that I came up with when I was attacking the harm reduction approach to substance abuse, because I did at one time, I've come to the conclusion, it doesn't matter if it's social model recovery, it doesn't matter if it's harm reduction recovery and that housing in Skid Row. Our problem is that the dope man was right in front of that housing selling the dope. How was any one of those programs going to work? So please, how are we going to make sure that we get the money this year for the people that take care of our parks and the part of Skid Row that doesn't have a bid?
Let's have the commander maybe address parts of that. Thank you for that question, too.
Thanks, Don. Hey, and thank you again. The problem we're having right now is the Skid Row Housing Trust maintains two parks. Maintains two parks in downtown Los Angeles, the only two parks in downtown Los Angeles, one on 5th and Gladys, and the other one down on 7th and Crocker. And they're great parks. One's right across from Parlos Niños. They got a Friday afternoon thing for the kids down there. The problem is their funding is coming due in March, I think it is, Anita. And the problem is we don't know where the money's going to come or if the money's going to come to maintain control of those parks and to maintain the security guards that are in those parks. And I tell you what, if there's no security guards in those parks, then we might as well just put a big fence around them and not let anybody in, because without the security guards that are there, those parks just become a lawless place that Don was describing.
But a lot of that money is tied to security guards that roam that no man's land that in that area without a bid that SRO has, you know, and That's important money for us.
The bids have been tremendous, and the bids, unfortunately, where the bids intersect, there's a couple of gaps in there. We were able to remove one down by South Park so that the Fashion District bid is now taken over, I think, a small chunk of that, so that place is getting covered. We definitely need to have bid coverage in there because it's a world of difference in a place that has a business improvement district and one that doesn't.
We have time for a few more questions. This gentleman first, then you. Right there.
Thank you. Just a quick question on numbers. The Cartifact map I found unbelievably informative, but I'm wondering, even with the reduction that we're talking about today from 5 years ago to now, would you, and I put this question to anybody, is Skid Row, what we call Skid Row, is it still the highest concentration of homeless in America today?
Well, you know what, it always, I guess I could probably answer that as well as anybody. You know what, I can't say for sure, Tom, whether that's the case, but I can tell you this, when we do the maps, if you look at the area immediately surrounding the police station, folks are allowed to sleep on the streets out there from 9 p.m. until 6 a.m. And if you come in before 6 o'clock, the concentration of folks on 5th Street, just right around the police station when they did the most recent map, is it's incredible. There's a lot of people are still there. I think they want to live near the police station, maybe because they feel safer, because there's cops coming and going all the time, and they recognize that, you know, that's a safe place to sleep. The Skid Row that we knew when we first started this whole business has compressed. The Main Street, I don't think anybody could say Main Street's part of Skid Row anymore, when in fact 2 years ago it was. And it's getting smaller and smaller, the area that we think of when we think of Skid Row. You don't see people camping out too much on Los Angeles Street now. We're thinking Skid Row's maybe even all the way over by Maple and Wall and maybe over towards Central. So it's compressing, but the density in that compressed area I think is still pretty high. I think we still have, you know, 500 or 600 people sleeping in just a few small blocks now at night.
Can I add an answer to this too? Because one of the reasons you have such a high concentration of homeless people in Skid Row is because in the rest of Los Angeles City and County, it has been extraordinarily difficult, if not impossible, to site programs that offer substance abuse treatment, that offer not only shelter, but that offer housing and support services for people who are homeless. So you are going to have a very high concentration of human distress in Skid Row until there is the political will and the neighborhood support to site housing and services for people who need them in the communities that they're already living in and that they grew up in many cases. And I think that is going to take really communicating to your elected officials in particular the support for every part of this region taking on its fair share of responsibility for meeting the needs of its most vulnerable citizens and neighbors.
If I can just add something to that, though, you know, some of the people, I'm not going to name names, who have been attacking the Safer City Initiative have raised this charge, not Carol, but of NIMBYism and blaming communities for not wanting their fair share. Well, that's very fine, but when these same critics are suing the LAPD on a yearly basis for trying to maintain order around facilities that are treating the mentally ill, that are treating addicts, it's quite understandable that communities are going to say, no, thank you. If this is what having social service providers in your neighborhood looks like, no, thank you, I don't want it. So, you know, if we're going to make the argument for fair share distribution, we darn well better be sure that we are giving the providers and the police the ability to maintain public order on the streets. And now, thanks to Commander Smith, there's a stronger argument for doing so, but the advocates cannot have it both ways.
Mark, you had something to say?
My understanding is that both the jail and the prison system continue to release people onto Skid Row, many of them at 2 o'clock in the morning, that due to the nature of the federal shelter subsidy laws, you're not eligible for shelter space the first night. You have to sleep a night on the street before you're eligible for shelter space. Seems to me there are a bunch of policies that everybody, you know, every time you say this, everybody says, oh yeah, that's a stupid policy. And then we go right back to discussing how we need more arrests as the solution to the problem. Seems to me that somebody gets out of jail, we ought to have a place for them to sleep that night. And it probably shouldn't be in Skid Row. I mean, is this rocket science?
Doesn't seem like it. I think we have time for one more question in this panel right here. Sorry.
This is for the think tankers in the room. My name is Jeff Page. I am a Skid Row resident. I've stayed in this housing by the Skid Row Housing Trust. And it's a building that does have supportive housing. And I just want to say that even though there are a lot of positives with the supportive housing system, I do think that it is flawed and it really needs to be fine-tuned. With that said, I just want to make the statement that I'm not sure if people are aware of, well, I know everyone's aware of the subprime fiasco that's going on in America, and I don't know if anyone has made concessions wondering if the families that could possibly come to the Skid Row area and due to financial illness. That's how I ended up on Skid Row, due to financial illness and having to blend in with the mentally ill and the drug, the other ills that are going on. I was just wondering if there's any concessions that have been made or considered in terms of other financially ill coming down to Skid Row and blending in with the ongoing problem that already exists.
Again, I would just say that the people like that are best helped by public order. And Mr. Garza said, if you're either trying to recover financially or through addiction, you're not helped by having a anarchy of drug dealing on the streets. So certainly people trying to go to find jobs, have a stable life, are not helped by carving out a sanctuary zone from the law. So I would say again, public order is a prerequisite there.
With that, we're going to close this panel and take a short break. Maybe you could join me in thanking